Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, April 10th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of our program. Later on, we'll be coming up with our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the national elections in the Horn of Africa state of Djibouti, where the incumbent president, Saleh, has won a fifth term. In the central and west African state of Chad, President Idriss Déby Itin is seeking to extend his tenure in office. There's been another explosion in the Somalian city of Baidoa, where several people were killed. And many countries are waiting for delivery of COVID-19 vaccines in an effort to end the year-long pandemic. In the second hour, we hear a briefing from the World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, on the status of efforts to curb the pandemic. Finally, we listen to an interview with yours truly, the host, Abayomi Azikiwe, as well as others on the impact of the counter-revolution in Libya 10 years after, among other issues. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'll take a musical interlude. We'll be back with more of our program for this week.
Le bon vin, il faut le boire.
I'm not going to be able to do that. Mama, Ongana ezali mopaya, openi kore kwate, Eliana nangai, amba pakosa, satona mwe.
Thank you. lise oye oye na linga ibile ina loba kona yo ya mwasi bena oye ya mobali ngai na tonda na yo
Thank you. Belle la yo na kata tour Eiffel bisengo
sima osili kobala
Kolwezi yambo yenu
habari gani asante sana eske lokola boyaki abosibo liaki aboliaki
bantu ya Lubumbashi eske mulisha
bayemba mulisha kula
Jiro senga na ye
na ye komi konza na yoge yambanga ye na ye o papa yo e yambanga mo paya o jiro senga na mana kio na bense nengo senga lokola bebe madiongo jiro o beta kima lokola mbake na mose na kumi balo dia na ye
Yaka is a fortunate
man, that you do.
Yosha, grip, oh, roll the shoes, roll the shoes. Meso Mwaki.
Thank you. zangi basi boyo zwa Soki peo suipo sabe umela seko Soki esini kanya nama esini mayo mito Iyambo na singa mina susi uko Iyambo na singa mina susi uko Ona yo Bambu ya nile Azali pola la eme Afana borgota Nalo na kita Zaki mafala matutu mana zoni Naputa ya mo Evi nita kene kamalase Nanya buki ya mbobo Oho Nanya veni ya mbobo Oho Potungisa moto moko temo Adame, sibeta beta Seke, seke, lala mambu Beti na nagima ni na mawa Sapo ni kwezu tie, kwezu tie Sina nagima ni na mawa Nazongi temo nido Natuni plemama Oli bozali kei na
Matrai, so fele kumangai, o pa kangana molokaye. Yeah. te wakolimisa kasenzala no mwana tu mopange Miko ya kalo kola nzala ata okoki mayango lala Mwakonyoso na mokili gazali mokoteli Oyo gazali omade kukutama kase awa onze Deke rago kubwa kanali pakuli okote Comme l'éducation des enfants et comme moi tous les dépendants Banina mai toko mela kama zali manduki makobo makamba toho Makosa la kai honi loko le kotia kama boko wedi waya motote Nazwa makama lelo nasuki mai mabo mani mandu Mazigi miso mara kizo ni mabo iko samara Yelelelelelele Yelelelelelelele Oh, la vie est sur la surprise. Bukavudawa.
Mwana mawanga yo 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 Nalela sebo boto banina
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 10th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We have to, of course, pay tribute to the great Papa Wemba. The music we just heard from a live concert in 1983. That was televised over national television in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment, and these are some of the headlines from today's Pan-African Newswire. Djibouti's government says longtime President Ismaël Omar Guelleh has overwhelmingly won a fifth term, citing provisional results. Home Affairs Minister Mumin Ahmed Sheikh told reporters overnight that Guelleh has received more than 98% of the 177,391 votes cast in the Horn of Africa nation, defeating his sole rival, a businessman, Zakaria Ismail Farah. Other opposition boycotted Friday's vote. The final results are expected to be announced later today by the National Electoral Commission. In other elections taking place on the African continent in Chad, President Idriss Déby Itno is seeking to extend his three-decade-long rule, running for a sixth time in this oil-producing Central African nation that is home to nearly half a million refugees and also plays a prominent role in the fight against Islamic extremism in the Sahel region. Giant portraits of Déby lined the streets of the capital of N'Djamena, and the incumbent leader has campaigned on the promises of building schools, paving roads, and improving living conditions in this country that remains one of the least developed in the world. Déby is widely expected to win in the first round, in part because two of the leading opposition candidates withdrew from the race as part of a boycott, and a third man, considered a top contender, chose not to run. The only remaining opposition candidate that has had the resources to campaign outside the capital is Albert Fahimi Badak, a one-time Déby ally who served as prime minister from 2016 to 2018. Badak has argued that the opposition boycott only benefits the president. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. In other news, in the Horn of Africa state of Somalia, a bomb detonated explosives outside a cafe in Somalia's city of Baidoa earlier today, killing at least four people and wounding more than six others. That's according to police. The bomber was targeting the Bay Region governor, Ali Wadhiri, who was outside the Suez cafeteria, officials reported. The governor escaped the explosion unharmed, according to the official government news agency, SONA, which reported that at least two of his bodyguards, who were also policemen, were among the wounded. The explosion, which was heard all around, to terrorize the people and had created a momentary confusion. That's according to Amin Mate. He was a witness to the explosion. He spoke to the Associated Press by telephone. And the Al-Qaeda-linked group Al-Shabaab has claimed the responsibility through a report they published on their website, Radio Andalus, which advocates for their jihadist campaigns. And finally, as many as 60 countries, including some of the world's poorest, might be stalled at the first shots of their coronavirus vaccinations because nearly all deliveries through the global program intended to help them are blocked until as late as June. COVAX, the global initiative to provide vaccines to countries lacking the clout to negotiate for scarce supplies on their own, has in the past week shipped more than 25,000 doses to low-income countries only twice on any given day. Deliveries have all but halted since Monday. During the past 2 weeks, according to data compiled daily by UNICEF, fewer than 2 million COVAX doses in total were cleared for shipment to 92 countries in the developing world, the same amount injected in Britain alone. On yesterday, the head of the World Health Organization slammed the shocking imbalance in global COVID-19 vaccination. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said that while one in four in the country's rich countries had received the vaccine, only one in 500 in poor countries had gotten a dose. And we're going to be hearing in the next segment from the World Health Organization, a report that was delivered from Geneva, Switzerland yesterday. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment. We want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website, and that's at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal worldwide radio broadcast for Saturday, April 10th, 2021, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program.
This is a house that Jack built, y'all. Remember the South. This was the land that he worked by hand. Yeah. It was the dream of an upright man. There was a room that was filled with love. Yeah. It was a love that I was proud of. This is the life that he planned. On the love, the same old love. In the house that Jack built.
The house that Jack built.
Remember the South.
Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, during the 1968 smash hit, The House That Jack Built. And right now we want to move into the World Health Organization briefing from Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. This was delivered yesterday in Geneva, Switzerland. Let's listen in. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast for today, Saturday, April 10th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast. And if you'd like to have access to this program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And the programs can be shared with other potential listeners. All you need to do is copy and paste the links into emails and send those emails out to other potential listeners. The programs can also be shared by copying and pasting the links on blogs and websites. And they can also be shared through social media networks, such as Facebook. And the Pan-African Journal is a weekly audio news magazine. And we broadcast from the city of Detroit. And, of course, we cover events taking place across Africa and, indeed, the international community.
Hello and good day to wherever you are joining us from today. It is Friday, 9 April 2021. My name is Christian Lindmeier, and I'm welcoming you to today's Global COVID-19 Press Conference. Our special guest today is Dr. Seth Berkley, Chief Executive Officer from Gavi. Simultaneous interpretation is provided again in the six official UN languages, Arabic, Chinese, French, English, Spanish, and Russian, and as well as in Portuguese and Hindi. Let me introduce the participants. Present in the room are Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General. Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director for WHO's Health Emergencies Program. Dr. Maria Van Kerkhoff, Technical Lead on COVID-19. Dr. Bruce Aylward, Special Advisor to the Director General and the Lead on ACT Accelerator. And last but not least, Dr. Rogerio Gaspar, Director for Regulation and Pre-Qualification. With this, let me hand over to the Director General for the opening remarks.
Thank you, Christian. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. As you know, at the beginning of the year, we issued a call for vaccination to begin in all countries within the first 100 days of the year. Tomorrow is day 100. Out of 220 countries and economies, 194 have now started vaccination and 26 have not. Of those, 7 have received vaccines and could start, and a further 5 countries should receive their vaccines in the coming days. That leaves 14 countries who have not yet begun vaccination for a range of reasons. Some have not requested vaccines through COVAX, some are not yet ready, and some plan to start in the coming weeks and months. COVAX has now delivered more than 38 million doses of vaccine to more than 100 countries and economies in the past 6 weeks. We are encouraged that almost all countries who want to start have now started. However, I emphasize the word start. Most countries do not have anywhere near enough vaccines to cover all health workers or all at-risk groups, never mind the rest of their populations. There remains a shocking imbalance in the global distribution of vaccines. More than 700 million vaccine doses have been administered globally, but over 87% have gone to high-income or upper-middle-income countries, while low-income countries have received just 0.2%. On average, in high-income countries, almost 1 in 4 people has received a vaccine. In low-income countries, it's 1 in more than 500. Let me repeat that. 1 in 4 versus 1 in 500. COVAX had been expecting to distribute almost 100 million doses by the end of March. But due to a marked reduction in supply, we have only been able to distribute 38 million doses. We hope to be able to catch up during April and May. COVAX works. It's a strong mechanism that can distribute vaccines faster and more efficiently than any other mechanism. The problem is not getting vaccines out of COVAX. The problem is getting them in. We understand that some countries and companies plan to do their own bilateral vaccine donations, bypassing COVAX for their own political or commercial reasons. These bilateral arrangements run the risk of fanning the flames of vaccine inequity. This is a time for partnership, not patronage. Scarcity of supply is driving vaccine nationalism and vaccine diplomacy. So Gavi, WHO, CEPI, and other COVAX partners are working on several options for accelerating production and supply. We are in ongoing discussions with the government of India about the supply of vaccines from the Serum Institute of India. We're working to accelerate the release and rollout of vaccines from SK Bio in the Republic of Korea. We're trying to expedite the delivery of the J&J vaccine. We're continuing to seek donations of doses from countries who have enough to cover their entire population several times over, not in several months' time, but now. We're expediting the review of more vaccines, including from Sinopharm, Sinovac, and Gamaleya. And we are in discussions with several countries as we seek to expand global manufacturing capacity. It is stunning to think that less than a year after the ACT Accelerator was launched, vaccines have been approved and vaccination has started in almost all countries. None of this would have been possible without our partners in COVAX, including Gavi. Today, I'm delighted to welcome my friend, Dr. Seth Berkley, the Chief Executive Officer of Gavi. Seth, thank you so much to you and your team for everything you have done and everything you continue to do. Thank you so much for your leadership. Seth, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Tedros, for your kind invitation to join you in this important moment. And I like to think of it, if we think as 2020 as the year of the pandemic, we aspire to make 2021 the year that vaccines gave us hope. Of course, as the ACT Accelerator always says, we need to make sure we have a comprehensive response, and we fully agree with that. We need, obviously, diagnostics, treatments, as well as other non-pharmacologic interventions. But, of course, what we hope is that vaccines will change the dynamic of this illness. So we're on our path towards fulfilling the vision of rapid access to participants. You've mentioned more than 100 economies. Actually, I think today we're at 105 economies. In the 6 weeks we began the ex-India COVAX deliveries in the first 100 days of the year. And these are being used, as you said, to protect healthcare workers, the elderly, and other risk groups. So this is an important milestone, but of course we still have enormous amount of work ahead of us as we seek to deliver at least 2 billion doses this year, which includes securing access and funding for 1.8 billion doses on behalf of the 92 lower income economies eligible to be supported by the Gavi COVAX Advanced Market Commitment. Our emphasis now is on, as you say, finishing the countries that do not have access now, but most importantly, scaling up the volumes to meet those at highest risk. To do this, we need continued support from governments and manufacturers, because every time a bilateral deal gets done around the COVAX facility, it means less doses for COVAX and for equitable distribution. In the second half of the year, we will see more suppliers come online and we'll be able to benefit from expanded production capacity at manufacturers that are already are supplying to us. But again, it's critical that we have solidarity and work, because what we're now beginning to see are supply constraints, not just of vaccines, but also of the goods that go into making vaccines, the filters, the bags that are necessary, the media. So one of the challenges is how we make sure we optimize supply for all of the manufacturers so that we can continue this unprecedented scale-up of vaccines. We're also talking to a number of high-income countries about sharing their surplus doses. We believe that this will be an important source of vaccines for COVAX in 2021. Lastly, we expect that lower-income countries will be able to buy additional vaccine doses through cost-sharing mechanisms we are developing, where they can purchase vaccines through COVAX, funded by multilateral development banks, therefore lifting the levels of protection further. Of course, we don't yet know exactly what 2022 is going to bring. Will we need new vaccines, which are going to replace the existing vaccines? Will we need booster doses just because of immunity waning, or will we need vaccines that are specifically targeted at some of the variants? These are scientific questions that continue to need to be getting attention. The country demand for COVID-19 vaccines has increased significantly in light of the new variants, and achieving greater population coverage to slow down the appearance of variant means the need for additional financing has become even more urgent. In order to achieve this goal and building on the contributions made by donors so far, Gavi will be seeking at least $2 billion in additional funding for the AMC in 2021 at the virtual investment opportunity event next week hosted by the United States. So in summary, we look forward to continuing this very important work with our partners in this unprecedented shared global endeavor. WHO, CEPI, UNICEF, PAHO, manufacturers, government, civil society, and the many others that form the effort to make sure that no one is left behind and that we can end the acute stage of this pandemic as one world protected. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Seth, for your leadership and partnership. I look forward to continuing to work with you to achieve our vision of vaccines for all. And even as we work to expand access to vaccines, we're continuing to keep a close eye on vaccine safety. Earlier this week, the European Medicines Agency and the Medicines and Other Health Products Agency from the United Kingdom said that unusual blood clots with low blood platelets should be listed as very rare side effects of the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine. The COVID-19 subcommittee of the WHO Global Advisory Committee on Vaccine Safety has reviewed available information from Europe and other regions and has said that a causal relationship between the vaccine and the occurrence of blood clots with low platelets is plausible, but more investigation is required. WHO, EMA, and MHRA continue to recommend that the benefits of the vaccine outweigh the risk of these very rare side effects. All vaccines and medicines carry a risk of side effects. In this case, the risks of severe disease and death from COVID-19 are many times higher than the very small risks related to the vaccine. And we continue to appeal to all people to please be careful. Vaccines are giving us light at the end of the tunnel, but we are not there yet. And vaccines are only one of the many tools we have to prevent infections and save lives. The right approach is a comprehensive approach. We must all continue to protect ourselves and those around us by making the right choices. We all have responsibilities as individuals and leaders in ending this pandemic. Christian, back to you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros, and thank you much, Dr. Berkeley. With this, I'll open the floor and remind everybody, in order to get into the queue, please push the raise your hand icon on the screen. And now we'll move to Stephanie Nebehai from Reuters. Stephanie, the floor is yours.
Yes, thanks. Thanks very much, Christian. I wondered whether either Seth or someone else from the WHO perhaps could comment on the supply situation a bit more about AstraZeneca, whether, given that some countries like Australia and Hong Kong have stepped back from AstraZeneca, are there talks going on with for instance, the Serum Institute or with AstraZeneca directly about getting more supplies for the COVAX program, please?
Thank you very much, Stephanie. And yes, I'll ask Dr. Berkeley to come in, please.
So thank you, Stephanie. The challenge we had, of course, is that when we first began negotiations with AstraZeneca, we ended up receiving doses from two different groups. One, the parent company, which had multiple supply chains associated with it, and second, the Serum Institute of India. What's happened, of course, is a confluence of events. One has been the rapid scale-up of vaccines. So the parent corporation has had a novel supply chain that has been a little slow to get off the ground. We ended up with some delays moving forward, getting regulatory approvals, getting quality assurance, quality control work done in a rapid period of time. But that has really picked up, and we've seen over the last couple of weeks increasing movement of doses, and we expect those to really be back to the pace we had originally planned very shortly. On the Serum Institute of India, as you know, India is suffering a very severe a wave of disease right now, and as a result, it has made an effort to increase its vaccinations, and as a result, the doses that had been commercially acquired from India have not been made available. Those have been kept domestically, and that has meant that we've had a slowdown. We've notified all of the countries involved, and we hope that that supply is going to improve over time. We do understand that countries have different choices for vaccines, and as countries decide that they are going to prioritize one vaccine or another, that may free up doses. And of course, in doing that, we will try to make sure that those doses are made available without delay if countries are willing to make that happen. We are in discussions with many countries to look at this as a potential possibility moving forward. Over.
Thank you so much, Dr. Berkeley. Let me now come to Tony Waterman from CGTN. Tony, please unmute yourself.
Thank you very much for taking my question. I was just wondering if we could have an update on the evaluation of the Sinopharm and Sinovac vaccines. Is a decision for the emergency use listing still expected at the end of April? Could it come sooner? And if both of those vaccines do receive the green light, will they be added to the COVAX facility? I believe both of them put in applications in January. And are there any talks for a supply deal underway at the moment? Thank you.
Thank you much, Tony, and I'll hand to Dr. Rogério Gaspar, Director for Regulation and Pre-Consultation.
No problem. This one. Okay, I'll take this one. So a very simple answer concerning Sinopharm and Sinovac. They are on the final stages of evaluation. A number of questions have already been answered, and we have convened the Technical Advisory Group for Vaccine Assessment for the 26th of April. And we expect that at least one of the two could make the time for that committee to be discussed there. If one of those cannot make it for the 26th of April, we are planning also to have another technical advisory group on the week of May 3rd. So between the 2 weeks, we expect that the final decision will be reached on the two vaccines. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gaspar. Let me now hand to Jamil Shad from Estado de Sao Paulo. Jamil, Oops, sorry, Dr. Aylward.
Yeah, I think Seth might want to come in on the second part of that question about the utilities products for the COVAX facility. I think as we've said in previous communications, let's take advantage of Seth being with us, but previous communications, through the COVAX facility, we are trying to ensure all vaccines are assessed irrespective of where they are made, where they're produced. We want to have as broad a portfolio of, as possible, and indeed have been in discussion with a broad range of manufacturers, including from China and elsewhere, in the course of setting up the facility. But perhaps Seth would like to speak to this issue as well.
Yeah, just to add to what Bruce said, of course, he's absolutely right. We are looking at any product. Of course, what we require first is that they are proven to be safe and efficacious, and that they do that through a stringent regulatory authority.
Can we just check it first?
Or through WHO pre-qualification or emergency use listing. But the second issue that we will be looking at, of course, is that the portfolio is well balanced and that there is cost effectiveness of the product. So there are a number of other steps that will be involved, but we are in discussions with all of the manufacturers that have vaccines out now, and we'll continue to do that until we determine that it makes sense to go ahead and purchase for the facility or not.
Thank you very much all for your answers. That was Dr. Seth Berkley, and before it was Dr. Bruce Aylward, and apologies for trying to cut the answers short. Now let's move to Jamil Shad from Estado Sao Paulo. Jamil, please unmute yourself.
Yes, Christian, can you hear me?
Very well.
Yes. Dr. Tedros, good afternoon. My question is about Brazil. At least one region in the country has more deaths than births at the moment. More than 4,000 deaths per day. My question to you is, if the federal government is not responding adequately, are you ready to go and talk straight to governors and mayors as well in order to get basically actions follow basically science and whatever recommendation you have? Are you ready to bypass, in a way, the federal government and talk straight to governors and mayors? Thank you very much.
Dr. Tedros, please.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. We're speaking to the federal government, and the latest was last Saturday, actually, with the newly appointed Minister of Health. And also we have discussed with other officials at the federal level. So that's, I hope, going to help with moving forward in our partnership. Thank you.
Dr. Ryan Chan?
Yeah, and just to add, as part of our normal technical cooperation with Brazil, our country office and our colleagues in PAHO very often work directly on technical and operational support at the state level. And in fact, we have a number of technical teams working at sub-national level. But obviously, our political engagement remains with the federal government, which is appropriate for us as an organization.
Thank you so much for these answers. And now we move to Robin Meyer from AFP. Robin, please unmute yourself.
Yes, thank you. France announced today that people under the age of 55 who've received a first dose of the AstraZeneca vaccine can switch to another vaccine for their second dose. On the mixing and matching between vaccines, in February when SAGE issued its recommendations on AstraZeneca, there was no data at that point on which it could recommend either way on mixing and matching. Are there any early indications from any data so far? Since then, and could mixing vaccines eventually prove beneficial, especially between different types of vaccine? Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Robin, for this. Let me ask Dr. Gaspar.
Let me be very clear about that. There's no available data to recommend that at this moment in time. So that's the only answer I can give right now.
Thank you for a crisp clarification, and now we move to John Zarokostas from Lancet. John, please unmute yourself.
Yes, good afternoon. My question is to Dr. Berkley. I was wondering, sir, you just mentioned earlier.
John, you seem to have pressed your mute button or we lost your try again, please.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, please go ahead.
Can you hear me? Yeah, all right, good. Yes, my question is to Dr. Berkley. You mentioned that you have expectations to have an increase in production in the second half of this year. Can you give us a bird's eye view how much anticipated increase you are looking at, even in your close talks with producers? Thank you.
Thank you very much,
thanks,
John. Dr. Berkley, be sorry.
Yes. So thank you for the question. We try to be as transparent as possible, even despite the changes that are occurring in the challenging supply situation. So on our website are published forecasts for what we expect to be happening, and those get adjusted regularly when there's a material change. The original plan was for about a quarter of the doses to be done in the first half of the year and three quarters in the second half of the year with scale up. I suspect that those ratios will shift perhaps a little bit more. It might be to go to 20% and 80%, but our goal is still to try to get to 2.3 billion doses by the end of 2021, assuming that there are not any major supply disruptions with any of the manufacturers. But please check on the website for further information.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berkley. And we'll move to Catherine Fiancon from France 24. Catherine, please unmute yourself.
Yes, thank you, Christian. Good afternoon to all of you. I mean, in fact, my question is a kind of follow-up of John's question. You spoke about the broad portfolio of vaccines that you have, but I would like to know if you have plans to increase the manufacturing capacity, and that means that having more manufacturers. Is there any existing plan for that in order to give access to everyone to vaccines? Thank you.
Dr. Berkley?
Yep. So thanks for that question. The answer is we are planning to increase the number of products. We're at 7 products now. We hope to get somewhere between 10 and 15 products, but we also hope to expand production both in numbers of sites as well as in the volumes those sites can produce. There is a COVAX manufacturing task force that is looking at technology transfer, is looking at how to expand production. But as I mentioned in my opening remarks, right now one of the worries is limitations in supplies. The world usually has about 3.5 billion doses of vaccine a year. When you add flu in, that jumps to about 5 billion. And the hope this year is to add another 10 billion, perhaps even as high as 12, 14 billion doses, which would be a quadrupling of capacity. So, of course, we are looking at every potential possible place that can do manufacturing and scale up in a reasonable time frame. Of course, building new plants is not something that can be done in that time frame. We do hope that as some of the countries now that are expanding their use of vaccines are able to saturate those use, that they will start making vaccines available, and those supply chains and vaccine facilities will become available for the global community as well.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berkley. Let me move to Gabriela Sotomayor from Progresso. Gabriela, unmute yourself, please.
Thank you, Christian. Thank you very much for taking my question. It's a follow-up on Brazil's situation. So I understand this concept of equity in vaccination, but Brazil is going through this so big emergency. I mean, it's terrible what is happening there. So is WHO thinking about scaling up vaccination for Brazilians, or send more vaccines there, or something to to help this country. Thank you.
Dr. Bruce Abbott, please.
Thank you very much, Gabrielle. Indeed, the situation is very, very concerning, what's happening in Brazil. And as you heard from the top of this organization, the Director General himself directly involved with trying to look at what advice we can provide, what support we can provide also through our regional office. In terms of vaccines, the bottom line is, as you've heard from the Director General in his comments and also Dr. Berkley in his comments, there simply is not the vaccine right now certainly available through COVAX to be able to try and help further reduce the risk to the people who are trying to deliver services during the outbreak there and also trying to the older populations at greatest risk of severe disease. The other thing to bear in mind, and I think Mike emphasized this in comments the other day and perhaps earlier today, is that the crucial thing to be doing right now are those proven steps that we know will slow down this virus in so many settings. That rapid identification of the cases, that immediate isolation, the quarantining of the people at risk. I know we've been saying it for a long time, but that is what most rapidly slows down the spread of this virus. Remember, even by the time you get vaccines into a country, by the time you get them into people and you're getting them to a relatively small proportion of the population, that will have a small effect in limiting the risk to some people. But what you're dealing with here is a raging inferno of an outbreak, and that requires population-level action in the rapid identification, isolation, quarantining, because you have to approach this at that scale to slow this thing down. So while indeed the vaccines that are available and are being used there to protect the essential workers are so crucial, and the older population, certainly through the COVAX facilities, we've said it's a moot point right now in terms of being able to get additional supply there. But the crucial thing are those measures can be applied at a massive scale that can slow this thing down.
Thank you very much. Dr. Elwood, Dr. Van Kerkhove, please.
Yeah, just quickly to come in on this, because I do want to emphasize the comprehensive nature of the approach that we've been articulating since the beginning of this pandemic. We need to stop thinking of this as one measure or another, or one measure over another. It's all of these measures together at an individual level, at community levels, supported by leaders, supported by governments. It isn't one measure alone that is going to end this pandemic. Vaccines and vaccination are another incredibly powerful tool, but they will not end this pandemic. What will end this pandemic is a comprehensive approach of everyone playing their part and being supported in being able to play their part. The trajectory of this pandemic around the world is going in the wrong direction. We have had 6 weeks in a row where there are increases in cases. Deaths are increasing as well, and we have tools right now that can prevent infections and can save lives. So we need to find reasons why measures aren't in place, whether these are policies or whether these are barriers to individuals carrying them out, and find solutions to actually get these in place. It is about doing it all. WHO has issued guidance. We're working with partners in member states on all modes of transmission around all different aspects of ways that you can keep yourself safe and your family safe. It's about your individual level measures of the distancing and the masks, avoiding crowded spaces, working from home if you can, also making sure that there's good supported clinical care and that health workers are protected with the right personal protective equipment, as well as being protected with the vaccines, with safe and effective vaccines that are rolling out around the world. And while we are waiting for production to increase and taking steps to increase that production, countries are ready to implement. We need the vaccines in hand so that they can implement vaccination for those who are most at risk. But in the meantime, we have to keep staying the course and do everything that we can. We just really need to stop saying it's vaccine only, it's vaccine and. And there's a lot of things that all of us can do right now.
Dr. Tedros, please.
Yeah, I fully agree with what has been said, Bruce and Maria. The only thing I'd like to add is, in our discussions with officials, including the minister, one area of discussion was how we can boost Brazil's local production for vaccines. And we're partnering on that, and I think local production would also help in boosting the volume of production of COVID vaccines. And Brazil has some capacity, and it will be a matter of boosting that, and we will continue to support them.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. No, we seem to be coming to the last question, and that one will go to Aswin Bashwinger from Observer Times India. Aswin, please unmute yourself.
Thank you for considering my question. My question is it necessary to have a chart on number of citizen vaccination of individual country along with its contribution to WHO's COVAX vaccination? In India, the state of Maharashtra have Hopkins Institute for Training, Research and Testing, which has performed a pivotal role in polio vaccination in India. Why government of India had kept such institution out of production in order to fulfill COVID-19 vaccination demands for domestic and international vaccination supply? Can WHO intervene and suggest government of India to get production of COVID-19 vaccine through Hopkins Institute? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Aswin, and let me hand to Dr. Aylward.
Yeah, thank you, Christian. I'm afraid I didn't quite follow the first part of the question, but I think it was about understanding what vaccines are being used where, and certainly that information is available on the COVAX website, on the WHO website, and also on the UNICEF website. We try to ensure as much transparency as possible, certainly in terms of the vaccines that are being used through the COVAX facility, and how many doses from SII, how many doses of AstraZeneca vaccines, et cetera, and then even which countries these are being allocated to. A core principle of the COVAX facility has been that all participants and indeed anyone in the world can have visibility on what's happening where. So there's a lot of work in that regard. And with respect to optimizing the use of available production capacity, be expanding vaccines production globally, every single country right now is looking at their options in that regard and in discussions. And I think there's no country that's got as much experience in this regard as India does. And of course, there's a wide range of producers, a number of whom are already engaged in, if not production of COVID vaccines that are licensed already. They're already looking at the development of such products. And I do know as well, in fact, we've been working closely with the ministries in the government that are responsible for supporting the production of medical products. And they have been working very hard with the institutions throughout India and potential producers who may be able to scale up production. So I think around the world we're seeing a common commitment, interest of governments to promote as much production as possible through as many sites as possible. From the WHO side, as Seth alluded to earlier, we're establishing now within COVAX a COVAX task force that will be focused to really bring even more, let's say, attention to this issue of expanding production. And WHO and CEPI, along with Gavi, will be leading up this effort to try and ensure that if there is underutilized capacity anywhere that does need support from any one of these agencies, we will do anything possible to help further expand production capacity globally.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aylward. With this, we come to the end of our briefing today, and I will ask Dr. Seth Berkley for any closing remarks. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I just wanted to come in on that last question because I think in that question, again, I had a hard time hearing it as well. I think he mentioned the issue of polio vaccines. And I want to emphasize one of the important priorities during all of this is to continue the use of routine vaccines and to make sure that we continue to produce the vaccines that we need to avoid other infectious diseases, because the worst case scenario would be epidemics of other diseases that would further strain the health systems and make it really impossible to get control over COVID. So I think it's very important that we get that balance right. And at the current time, we are seeing manufacturers continue to produce the vaccines we need for the routine vaccines and even those that are necessary for other epidemic infectious diseases that we are seeing, of course, simultaneously, whether they be Ebola, yellow fever, cholera. Those productions need to go on and continue to make sure there is provision of these vaccines to try to keep the world as free of infectious diseases as we can during this very difficult time. Again, thank you. It's a real pleasure to be with my colleagues at WHO in working together on this problem, and we look forward to our continued partnership.
Thank you very much, Dr. Berkley, and thank you, of course, for joining us today. Before I hand to Dr. Tedros for the final remarks, as usual, the audio files will be posted right after the press conference today, and the full transcript will be available tomorrow morning on our website. For any other follow-ups, please contact media inquiries at who.int. Dr. Tedros, the floor is yours.
So thank you so much, Seth, for joining us today, and again for your leadership. And I would also like to thank the media, colleagues from the media, for joining us today. So bon weekend, see you next week. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. That was a briefing from the World Health Organization in Geneva, Switzerland, from yesterday, discussing the inequitable distribution of vaccinations, problems with vaccination distributions, not only in countries outside of the Western industrialized states, but also within Europe and in the United States as well. So right now we want to take a break. We'll be back with more of our program. Welcome back, the beautiful voice of the legendary Candy Staten. And darling, you all that I had, and you all we have here at the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio broadcast for today, Saturday, April 10th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we want to move into a rebroadcast of Global Research News Hour featuring the host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and one of the segments from this program that was broadcast last month. Let's listen in.
What were the goals behind the assault on Libya 10 years ago? What are the broader implications of the assault on sovereignty throughout Africa? Who generated the pretext for a humanitarian war? How did slavery of the black African migrant population get started? What memories are preserved in the mind of one correspondent among several left stranded during the thick of the conflict? This week on the Global Research News Hour, on the 10th anniversary of the NATO-based assault on Libya, we attempt to unravel what happened during and since the war and where this leaves the Libyan people and the wider continent today. We first speak with Abayomi Azikiwe of Pan-African Newswire about the motives of the West and their failure to control the situation and how the future looks for the country. Then, in the second half hour, Mahdi Nazem Roya makes his return to the show, elaborating on what he experienced there during the war and how the country will prevail despite the devastation of this war. On this week's program, The Ides of March, Part 2, NATO's Humanitarian War on Libya. The people survived 10 years after its launch. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 19, 2021. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, unoccupied Anishinaabe Gaki, the homeland of the Métis and the historical territory of the Nihiyawakan and Nakota. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are features on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Ahead of Thursday's meeting, Blinken and U.S. War Secretary Lloyd Austin are visiting Japan and South Korea through Wednesday for discussions focused on China and North Korea, non-belligerent nations threatening no one. Last Friday, Biden's double participated in a virtual summit with leaders of India, Japan, and Australia, so-called Quad nations, their meeting discussed in a Monday article. Their alliance is all about countering China's growing prominence regionally and worldwide. The U.S. seeks to undermine Beijing's political, economic, technological, and military development, what failed so far and is highly unlikely to fare better ahead. Regional instability, to the extent that it exists, is because of Washington's imperial presence, its rejection of peace, stability, and cooperative relations with all nations regionally and worldwide. That comes from the article, Upcoming Sino-U.S. Talks in Alaska, by Stephen Lendman, posted March 17th. From the east bank of the Bosphorus to Tokyo Bay, it accounts for half of global economic output and more than half the world's population. And this is growing. Within its geography, it has the world's two most populous nations, China and India, and the second and third largest economies in the world, China and Japan, as well as the world's largest democracy, India. The Asia pivot is a tantalizing prospect, but how well has lockdown London thought this through? That comes from the article, Britain's Pivots to Asia to Contain China, a
Imperial Overreach, Wishful Thinking and Delusion, by Tom Clifford, posted March 17th. There are reports that Turkey, after sending militants to Azerbaijan and Libya, is now priming to send Syrian mercenaries to Yemen. They are to fight on behalf of the Saudi-led coalition against Ansar Allah. In case of emergency, Iran is likely to provide the Houthis with some more support in the form of weapons and hardware, as it has done repeatedly in the past. On March 15th, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps revealed a brand new advanced missile site, which is essentially an underground city. Iranian state media dubbed it an advanced missile city containing cruise and ballistic missiles able to hit targets at multiple ranges and with a 360-degree firing radius. That comes from the article, Video, the Houthis continue their push, but is Erdogan coming to the Saudi kingdom's rescue? By South Front, posted March 17th, originally published at South Front. 45% of Americans now say China is the greatest enemy of the U.S., more than double the percentage who said so in 2020. That year, Americans were equally as likely to say either China or Russia was the U.S.'s greatest enemy. The current shift coincided with a period when the global economy and human activity were severely impacted by the coronavirus pandemic, which originated in China. The February 3rd to 18th poll also finds favorable views of China among U.S. adults falling for the second straight year, putting the figure at a historically low 20%. The rise in perceptions of China as the United States' greatest enemy is accompanied by a sharp decline since 2020 in those mentioning Iran, down 15 percentage points to 4%, as well as 4 to 5 point declines in mentions of Iraq and North Korea, and smaller declines in a handful of other countries. That comes from the article, New High in Americans' Perceptions of China as U.S.'s Greatest Enemy, by Mohammed Yunus, posted March 17th, originally published in Gallup. Today, the rejuvenated Syrian armed forces have restored government control over much of its territory, with only Idlib province remaining as a last bastion of the Islamists who once threatened to raise the black flag of their movement over Damascus. But chaos still reigns. Northeastern Syria remains under Turkish and U.S. occupation, with these two ostensible allies fighting a proxy war of sorts over the future of the Syrian Kurds living there. The Islamic State, whose dreams of caliphate were destroyed by the combined efforts of the Syrian government, Iran, Iraq, Russia, and the United States, continues to exist as an ideology capable of motivating tens of thousands of sympathizers to carry out terrorist attacks in support of their cause. And Israel is engaged in an increasingly hot war inside Syria to drive the forces of Iran and Hezbollah out of Syrian territory. The primary facilitator of this chaos is the United States. Even after the intervention of Russia in September 2015 closed the door on any hope for regime change in Syria, the U.S. continues to push the same failed formula, but this time expanding its scope and scale to include the goal of getting Russia and Iran to cease their support for the Assad government by making the cost of their continued presence in Syria too high. That comes from the article, 10 years on, the U.S. still promotes failed regime change policy in Syria, by Scott Ritter, posted March 17th, originally published at RT Op-Ed. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. As of the first date that this show goes to air, it will have been 10 years since the NATO started dropping bombs on Libya, only 2 days since the no-fly zone was instituted by the UN. This conflict continued for 7 more months. Eventually, Muammar Gaddafi was attacked by the counter-revolutionary forces and assassinated brutally. Since his fall, everything in the country has gone wrong, at worst. We want to see the role of France, the United States, and the West in orchestrating the attack and the gains and losses as measured today. Joining me to discuss this subject is Abeyomi Azikiwe. He's the editor of the Pan-African Newswire, an electronic press agency that was founded in 1998. The Pan-W represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African affairs. Welcome again, Abeyomi Azikiwe.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, the humanitarian gains at the time were being stressed then. It wasn't very credible then, and it certainly isn't now. Could you outline what were the true strategic roles of the countries involved to understand what guided Europe and the United States into launching the attack in the spring of 2011?
Well, it was a concerted effort by numerous NATO countries and their allies in the region to overthrow the government in Libya and to seize its assets and to impose a client regime in Tripoli. Now, it failed miserably because the resistance of the Libyan people to what the U.S.-led effort was carrying out. And then, of course, there was the fracturing of the armed opposition groups, which were funded and coordinated and given diplomatic cover by Washington, London, Brussels, and Paris, and their allies in the region. That was the underlying reason. And then, of course, Libya being an oil-rich country, it was also a country that virtually owed no money to the IMF, the World Bank, or the international financial institutions, which had over $170 billion in a sovereign wealth fund, which was seized by the imperialists during the course of 2011. And then a strategic location, right at the Mediterranean, the gateway to other countries of North and West Africa. And Libya, of course, had been a center of the imperialist efforts during World War II. In 1943, when Britain and the U.S. Were involved in trying to defeat the Italians and the German fascists in North Africa, they constructed a air base, the Wheelis Air Base in Libya, and it played a very important role militarily in the region. Prior to that, Libya had been a center of imperialist war and conquests from 1911 to 1931. And, of course, in 1922, Mussolini had taken over in Europe 11 years prior to the ascendancy of Adolf Hitler. So, yes, Libya historically, well over a century, has been a focal point for imperialist intrigue. And now what we see, of course, after a decade of genocidal warfare, beginning on February 17th of 2011, and then with the UN Security Council sanctioning on March 19th of 2011, and the blanket bombing of the country, the theft of its wealth, the embargo in terms of arms and
economic trade and resources. And then, of course, the fracturing of the opposition groups and the concomitant civil war that has gone on for the last decade, the country has been virtually brought to its knees. And now we have yet another United Nations Security Council engineered interim government in Libya that was actually chaired and endorsed yesterday in Tripoli. And perhaps we can talk about that as well, because this, in my opinion, does not portend well for the future of the country, because we've seen the same process fail beginning in 2015 as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, certainly. I just want to maybe resurrect a little bit about Muammar Gaddafi himself. I mean, all that he'd contributed over the last 41-year period that he'd been leading the country. You just remind us briefly how his efforts contributed to the overall forces within Libyan society.
Yeah, well, after World War II, there was an independence in Libya in 1951 under a monarchy, and the country was largely underdeveloped despite its tremendous oil wealth and its strategic geopolitical positioning. And then, of course, when the Revolutionary Council took over in 1969, Libya declared itself an anti-imperialist country. They attempted to normalize relations with Egypt, which was then headed by Gamal Abdel Nasser, who died there the following year. They broke relations with Israel, and they also told the United States they had to dismantle the Wheelers Air Base. So Libya was always a thorn in the side of the imperialist countries. And then utilizing the oil wealth of the country and its anti-imperialist politics, Muammar Gaddafi and his supporters were able to build up the country to the most prosperous and developed state in Africa, rivaling even states in Europe. In fact, being in a position to loan money to political figures in France and in Italy, Italy being their former colonizer of Libya. And also they funded a lot of the national liberation movements in Africa and around the world, trained them. It was also a center for international solidarity conferences. So Libya really was a very, very important country as far as the movement against imperialism, for Pan-Africanism, for Pan-Arabism, and for socialism. That is another reason why it was considered a threat to Western plans. And at the same time that they launched this counter-revolution in Libya, they also did a similar situation in Syria. So 2011 was a very, very important year in terms of reactionary politics. And this was done under the Obama administration, which had come in on the heels of the George W. Bush Jr. administration. And there was a lot of anti-war sentiment in the United States. But they subverted that by claiming that there was human rights violations in the eastern part of the country and that there was genocide going to happen if they didn't intervene. And all this, of course, was never substantiated. It was all a fabrication, as was the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and the Al-Qaeda threat in Afghanistan. And the problem is these wars are still going on. You still have U.S. troops in Syria. You still have U.S. Forces intervening in Libya. You still have the United Nations Security Council engineering a new interim government. And the instability in particularly West Africa has worsened over the last decade. If you look at the situation in Mali, in Niger, in Burkina Faso, and in Chad, as well as in Nigeria, you can trace it right back
to developments in Libya that occurred in 2011.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier how in Tripoli, so much had been taking place, and so much you, from the standpoint of outside forces, has seems to be taking us in a wrong direction. Even Barack Obama said that it was the worst, the biggest mistake of his presidency. And so
it's not like people didn't tell him it was a mistake at the time. He refused to listen because I know myself and a lot of colleagues and comrades in this country in 2011, spoke out against the war and demonstrated against the war, and he completely ignored it. So that's a very disingenuous statement.
Mm-hmm. Although at the same time, there was a lot, I mean, among the African Americans, there was the highest support among Africans, among them than among other generations the highest ever support by African American for it. At the same time, probably related to Barack Obama's heritage. But when you're looking forward with all of these disasters, and Muammar Gaddafi's ability to take the territorial terrain and sort of keep them in check, how are they going to move forward? Are they going to, is it going to come down to eventually some kind of sectarianism, or how can outside forces, the UN and so forth, working with a puppet, be able to retrieve this situation in any way?
Well, this is a major issue involving Libya because they attempted this on several occasions. If we look at 2011, that was an attempt to set up a client regime. When that failed in 2015, they set up another one. And then, of course, there was a conflict between Khalifa Haftar and the Sarraj government in Tripoli, which lasted about 4 years, which reached a military and political stalemate. And there is now an attempt to reconstruct, another interim government. And this government is headed by Mohamed Yunus Menfi. He heads the presidential council in Libya. And there's a prime minister, Abdul Hamid Beba, who is ostensibly the head of the government. And the Tunisian president, neighboring Tunisia, Kais Saied, he met yesterday in Tripoli with this UN brokered interim regime in Libya. And some of the discussion, of course, centered around trade, because prior to the counter-revolution under Gaddafi, even though Tunisia and Libya had different political systems and economic systems, they had a trade volume of $1.2 billion annually, U.S. dollars annually. And that's deteriorated by some 70-80% over the last decade. There's also was a question of two Tunisian journalists that had disappeared in eastern Libya in 2014, and they've never been accounted for. The Islamic State, which the antecedents of, the predecessors of, were used in 2011 to overthrow the Gaddafi government. These are people who the United States claims are terrorists, but they're willing to arm them to fight, to carry out their foreign policy objectives. ISIS said that they had killed these two Tunisian journalists. And this was the first visit by Tunisia in 9 years to Libya. This is a neighboring country, and there has been no diplomatic exchange in 9 years. Now, Tunisia had hosted the talks in November for creating this Libyan political forum, but it remains to be seen exactly what the outcome of this is going to be. And with the international involvement from the U.S., France, Britain, Italy, Russia, Turkey, we'll have to see how things turn out. There's supposed to be elections in December where there'll be an elected government in Libya. So we'll be monitoring the situation very closely.
Yeah, and I guess one more question. That has to do with the larger implications for Africa, because I know Muammar Gaddafi was a major force within this African Union, a kind of a pan-African force, I guess you might say, and now that's pretty much demolished. So what kind of, in terms of a pan-African force, how can the opposition to this, I mean, this was the very first AFRICOM operation. How can this resistance to AFRICOM and to the other American and European powers form themselves with the current situation in Libya?
Yeah, you're right. This was the first full-blown AFRICOM project, was the counter-revolution in Libya. And they were also involved in the overthrow of Laurent Gbagbo in Cote d'Ivoire and Ivory Coast, which was also a failure because they took him to the International Criminal Court and they could not build a case against him. And now they're negotiating his return. But the question is, the African government and the people, the mass organizations, have to take a firm position against the African command, the U.S. African command, because they will always intervene in a very negative and counter-revolutionary manner. So the AFRICOM has been a total failure. It has created more instability in Africa, which rationalizes its continued existence in the country. Now, under the Jemadia system in Libya, they were leaders in the demands for African unity. In fact, the transition from the Organization of African Unity, which was formed in 1963 in Ethiopia, with people like Kwame Nkrumah and Haile Selassie, Secretary Ray, Modibo Keita, Julius Nyerere, and so forth, there was a transition to the African Union, and the initial discussions began in Sirte, Libya, which was the home of Gaddafi, in 1999 at the Sirte summit, and they issued a Sirte declaration, which made the transition by 2002 to the African Union, which has much stronger resolutions and protocols related to African unity, even though it's by no means close at this point because of the continued dependency economically and politically on imperialism. But that was a contribution that Gaddafi made. It was a continuation of the work of the founders of the OEU, people such as Nkrumah and Secretary Ray and Modibo Keita and Nyerere and so forth. And also, today there's the African Continental Free Trade Area, which is a framework, for the creation of greater unity in terms of a single currency and enhancement of trade between different African states. So, but in order for these plans to be realized, imperialism and imperialist militarism have to be defeated on the continent. And that is the only real way forward for the continent and its 1.3 billion people.
Okay, well, Abayomi Ezekwe, it's really a pleasure having you back on this show. I want to thank you for being a willing guest, and thank you as well for your regular work at Pan-African Newswire. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much.
I've been speaking with Abayomi Ezekwe. He's the editor of Pan-African Newswire and also a regular contributor to Global Research.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. For 2 months during the summer of 2011, Mahdi Darius Nazemroya was stationed in Libya and functioning as a correspondent of both Pacifica Radio's Flashpoints and of Global Research.
Upon his return to North America, the 29-year-old relayed alarming details of what happened in the country. He wrote several articles about the attack on Libya and did media appearances. Mahdi Darius Nazamroya is an interdisciplinary sociologist, award-winning author, and noted geopolitical analyst. He was awarded the prize of the Mexican Press Club for his outstanding achievements and writings as a war correspondent for the independent media. Global Research NewsHour got hold of him for an interview. But first we wanted to re-air part of his interview for CKUW's Warning Shots. Here is a couple of excerpts of that conversation as carried out by CKUW journalist Scott Price.
What kind of activities, what kind of things were they doing? What kind of people are these the rebel forces?
Well, the rebels, one thing that I saw with my own eyes and I actually taped is they were involved in destabilization efforts, like attacks to cause fear. And they were involved in targeted attacks against regime officials or figures of power. And they actually one night attacked one of the hotels I was at before the Tripoli so-called fall. They did that, and they actually blew up some bombs. Like they used detonated bombs made out of something crude, almost like TNT. I think it's called gelatine. The Libyans called it, I believe. They blew some up around the place they were going to target, and this was a danger to civilians. They did it regardless, and then they attacked with their rifles, and they shot at the hotel, and there were civilians in the way, and that's one of the things that they did. And I'm talking about the Radisson on the Mediterranean coast. This is what they did at the Radisson Blue. They also they were putting explosives in government ministries in public places, like the Justice Ministry, for example, had an explosive put in terrorist attacks. They did. They also used RPGs for attempted assassinations. Also, once again, they attacked hotels like the Corinthian. Just before, I think, they attacked the Radisson, there was an attempt on a government official's life at the Corinthian using RPGs. And the Libyans were very sure that NATO's intelligence services were involved in this. So this is the stuff they were doing in Tripoli. And NATO was helping them by also attacking any electricity infrastructure, so they would be dark at night in Tripoli, and they were using the blanket of night to attack. That's why the Libyans, and this caused a lot of fear and psychological trauma, and the Libyans were afraid. Of course, fear is a big enemy in a state of war. It's what could cause people to defect or to run away or to be helpless, you know. Mm-hmm. So fear was part of the psychological war. So the Libyans, what they did is, because of the attack on electricity infrastructure, and it was deliberate and calculated, it was part of the military strategy, which, once again, I want to point out, has nothing to do with humanitarianism or a no-fly zone, which by definition is defensive, not offensive. Anyways, so they were attacking the electricity infrastructure, and the Libyans, what they did is they stopped the electricity from being used during the morning. So there was no electricity in the morning, so they could have it at night, so there would be stability. So this is the type of stuff that was ongoing. And, of course, I saw refugees coming from the east of Libya, eastern Libya, which is called Cyrenaica. That's the old name of the region during the monarchical times and ancient times. They were coming, and they had terrible stories to tell about Benghazi and what was going on in the east. Of course, the Libyans were gathering a lot of evidence about what's going on in the east. There was rape victims, gang rape victims who came, who were brutalized and victimized, you know, not just by Libyan rebels, but by foreigners. A lot of these people were not Libyan. I want to emphasize this. A lot of the people in the so-called rebels or insurgents ranks were non-Libyans. They were Arabs from other countries or non-Arabs, okay? So this is very important. If this is a revolution, you do not need these type of people in your ranks. And there was a lot of Egyptians, for example, and people from other parts of the world, including Afghanistan, war-torn Afghanistan, who came there. And they were involved in beheadings there, cutting people's arms off, mutilating them, impaling, these type of disgusting things, which actually some of the evidence is very available. It's been available for months on the Internet about what's been going on. But instead, people focus on the lies of Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and the misinformation that CNN gives and the BBC gives.
That was Mahdi Nazem Roya talking with Scott Price back in September of 2011. Here he is now speaking to the Global Research NewsHour about his thoughts 10 years later.
Looking back on what happened, it's very clear that this was an unjust war. Nobody should have any illusions about that, and I don't think anybody does. I think to put NATO's war against the Libyan Arab Jamhuriya within the framework of a historical context and analysis, I'd have to say that this was clearly part of a new scramble for Africa that started with a colonial objective of controlling that part of the world, of breaking a sovereign state, of basically pirating and looting a relatively wealthy country. I just think of what was called the Great Depression in the past, and in retrospect, what historians call the Long Depression, which hit Europe, North America from 1873 to 1893. And that depression or economic hard period was what led to Europeans pushing for direct control of Africa. And I think that this is what, to an extent, in part, was one of the reasons for the push into Libya and other countries in the world. And I think that even today, what we're seeing, all this fear-mongering against China and all these measures, health measures, public health measures, are an extension of this economic decline or maybe economic restructuring in so-called Western core countries, like in the European Union and Canada, the United States, as well as some non-Western countries that are part of that capitalist core. I think that that's the context I look at it from. A lot of things have also changed, interesting things, like, you know, new alliances, and for example, Turkey and Russia getting closer on certain things. Of course, there's a rivalry, but if I can use the popular term from vernacular, frenemies, you know, friends and enemies, you can see both the Russian Federation and Turkey are active players in Libya. To an extent, Iran is, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, well, Qatar's been pushed, but Egypt, France, and then there's this push for the oil, and the Turks are trying to make a power grab with this route, you know, and the different fractions and alliances have been readjusted on the ground in the country. So it's been very dynamic, but we shouldn't be fooled. The country's still been weakened. It was Balkanized. That's why you have different factions and basically de facto governments, aside from the de jure legal government, UN-backed government that Turkey supports in the capital, Tripoli, in northwestern Libya on the Mediterranean coast. Besides that, there's other factions in the mountains and in the east, and they're supported by external powers. So, I mean, the country was divided, and, you know, the intelligence analysts in the United States, in Washington, D.C., the Beltway there, and in other parts of the world, specifically, I mean, other parts of the countries that are within the NATO alliance, they all knew that this would be an outcome. And they still supported these forces that, forces that they portrayed as largely being under the blanket of some democratic movement, liberal democratic movement. They portrayed them as these freedom fighters, Democrats, which they weren't. Many weren't. I'm not saying there were not people. I'm not saying that people with democratic liberal tendencies were absent from that type of a movement. There was some people like that, but largely not, especially on the fighters on the ground.
Marty, I was wondering, I mean, the fact is that when they went in, there was a lot of a development of a compassionate message, you know, a humanitarian effort, you know, and I mean, there was a certain amount of the whole Arab Spring thing, but this push by human rights organizations, I mean, what was the basis for that? I mean, how did that aspect manage to push this thing in a certain direction, and what was the outcome at the end of the day? I mean, what were they saying then, and what are they saying today in terms of the human rights record?
Well, I mean, the entire project, the entire war, the entire framework and the rhetoric, and it was rhetoric, was two-faced, hypocritical. It was never about helping the Libyan people, and it was never about human rights. And the Human Rights Council, we have the records of what happened in the Human Rights Council, how they used this NGO complex, a group of NGOs basically to vilify Libya, and they broke procedures. I wrote about this, like, in depth, about the role of the NGOs and what type of NGOs were involved, who were just used to target specific countries and use human rights as a shield to justify war and the actual violation of human rights. So, I mean, that's what happened in the United Nations office in Geneva, somewhere that I actually went a few years after the war to speak about Syria. But, the role was to use this framework, this discourse, this liberal discourse of this humanitarian liberal discourse of helping others. The responsibility to protect R2P. You have to go in there to help. This is about the people. I mean, this type of dishonest discourse is going on, whether it's fighting terrorism or law and order or public health. They're always using some type of greater good framework to justify very nefarious, selfish, and projects that aren't about the greater good whatsoever. And that's what it down.
What were some of the, maybe the a couple of the key organizations that were pushing this thing through?
Well, key organizations would include the National Endowment for Democracy Support. There was several Libyan groups outside of the country that were part of this. In fact, one of the figures in one of these Libyan groups, it was tied to the U.S.-supported opposition, ended up becoming the ambassador of Libya right after the war. And he admits that the whole thing, on tape, he admits that the whole thing was fabrication. It was all fabricated, and this was used to justify attacking a sovereign state, removing its government, and basically what amounts to a war crime.
In particular, and I think this is a point that needs to be drawn out, what's happened to the African migrants, the black migrants in particular, they've gone through torture, they've gone through murder, and slavery is back as well. How did these events happen? Was it partly with the outcome of the media itself, right? Or like how is it escalated to the point where you're having this brutality against, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of people in the country now?
Okay, well, let's mention a few things about Libya. The country is, I mean, it's a country that's always had various people. It's at a crossroads, and a certain portion of the population are black-skinned Libyans. All Libyans are African. There's by the sheer fact that Libya is in the African continent. The issue that you brought up, which is very important, it has several factors. You brought up migrants. Well, yeah, Libya was filled with migrants from other North African and sub-Saharan African countries. These migrants were targeted as part of this discourse that was propagated by Western media. It was alienating and very racialized and racist terms, making it look like anybody who's black-skinned is not Libyan and has to come from outside and was brought there as basically a mercenary against the Libyan people, which is not true. Many of these so-called Africans, meaning people with black skin, basically. I'm saying so-called, as in quotation marks, emphasis on this, were Libyans. They were Libyan nationals. It was disgraceful, but the media was part of this discourse, disgusting discourse, making them look like foreigners in their own country, and propagating hate and supporting hate, supporting rumors that anybody with black skin had to be a supporter of Muammar Gaddafi, and basically giving a green light to people, right, people that would blame them, scapegoat them. And of course, this led to these problems. In terms of people that aren't Libyan with black skin, well, they were coming to work in Libya, and I mean, the situation in Libya also not only destabilized Libya and the neighboring countries, but a much broader region of the world in Africa, like the Sahel area, was destabilized. Weapons started going from there to Mali, and problems started sprouting up in Chad, economic problems, famine problems, lack of economic development, crime, lack of border control. I mean, there was always problems with lack of border control, and to be frank, some slavery was already existent in the south of Libya. Not Libya, I mean south of the state of Libya's borders. But this problem just exploded after this. And this has led to more people trying to go through a no man's land and cross through Libya to Europe, because Libya is also at the crossroads in the Mediterranean. So it's led to this two-pronged problem where people with so-called Africans, they're all Africans, I want to emphasize that. Anybody who's Libyan is an African, regardless of their skin color, and are trying to leave their country or are internally displaced or become refugees. And at the same time, you have people in other parts of Africa becoming refugees, internally displaced, or migrants, or have economic problems and are seeking to go northward across the Mediterranean. And this was, there was a domino effect approach here. And then the United States, Britain, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, they all had a role to play with this. And part of that was through their support for this war war crime. I think war crimes, this was a large war crime that took place. And I want to point out one thing. The United States already had plans under Robert Gates, before he was U.S. Secretary of Defense in the Obama government, when he was part of the National Security Council. He drafted plans, secret plans. Only 24 officials were part of it. That had two subcomponents. One was called TULIP, and the other one was called ROSE. TULIP was the code name for CIA covert operations. to overthrow Colonel Muammar Gaddafi and his government by supporting exile groups in countries such as Egypt that wanted Muammar Gaddafi removed from power. ROSE was the code name for a surprise attack to be carried out on Libya using the territory of U.S. allies like Egypt. And at the time, Italy wasn't included, like Italy, and supported by American air power. And this all played out. This is exactly what they did. So they actually took a few years, but more than a few decades, they actually ended up implementing Tulip and ROSE, where we have these Libyan exiles, and we have a U.S. military campaign against Jamhuriya.
Maybe I should finish off with one more question. In that, you know, you were in there. You met.
Welcome back. And that was a rebroadcast of a Global Research News Hour from March 19th. And you just heard Mari Nassim Roya and yours truly earlier, Abayomi Azikiwe, talking about the 10th anniversary of the counter-revolution engineered by the U.S. and NATO against the North African state of Libya, against the Jamhuriya socialist system led by Colonel Muammar Gaddafi. And that's going to end our program for today, Saturday, April 10th, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, just log on to the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire, just log on at panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, with our theme Devil with Symphony Sid, done by the Tad Dameron Group, we bring you and bring our microphones right down here to the Royal Roost, Metropolitan Opera House, here at 1580 Broadway, between 47th and 48th Street, where the lights are low, the music with that real knocked-out groove, and the people wonderful. Right now, I'd like to introduce to you the gentlemen of the Tad Dameron Organization. Tad Dameron, wonderful musician, one of the greatest in small group jazz. Here he is. Let's give him a great big hand, Tad Dameron. Ladies and gentlemen... And not to waste too much time, let's bring to you a few of the other gentlemen. On trumpet, one of the greats of all time, Fats Navarro. Fats Navarro, ladies and gentlemen. And on tenor, a wonderful guy, Alan Eager. Alan Eager, ladies and gentlemen. And then, of course, it's Curly Russell on bass and Kenny Clark on drums. Let's give them all a great big hand. And here's one of the great things that you always ask for when you call in the studio at Circle 6, 2500, the all-night, all-frantic show, The Squirrel. lot, ladies and gentlemen, and that was a squirrel. Well, here's one you always asked for. It was arranged originally by the great Tad Dameron, one that Dizzy made, and I hope you enjoy it. Good bait. Let's bring back the great Tad Dameron organization, ladies and gentlemen. Tad Dameron, a wonderful thing, one you ask for very often, thing called anthropology. Right now, ladies and gentlemen, let's bring Pancho back again. Pancho Kennyhager to do Kitchenette Across the Hall, a real novelty thing, one I hope you really enjoy. Pancho, it's all yours.
I met her in a grocery store. She was buying groceries galore. To my surprise, I found she lived next door. In the kitchenette across the hall. Next morning, many thanks to fate, I had to wait because the bus was late. I kept thinking how she looked at eight in the kitchenette across the hall. Then one day she lost her key. Gee, that was a break for me. I had to climb in her window. She invited me to tea. I'm gonna buy your wedding ring. Well, to the kitchenette across the hall. Grocery store, food galore, she lost her key. What a break for me, I was good bait for the kitchenette across the hall.